us to English Radio at sign IRIB.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The headlines: Iran repeats its demand for the removal of all U.S. sanctions in a verifiable manner to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Israeli settlers attack a Palestinian village in the occupied West Bank and hurl stones at villagers. And the European Union summons Russia's ambassador to Brussels to convey its, quote, strong condemnation and rejection of Moscow's retaliatory sanctions on European officials.
Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us.
Iran has once again reiterated that the U.S. should remove all sanctions it imposed, reimposed, or relabeled after leaving the 2015 nuclear deal before the Islamic Republic accepts results of the ongoing talks in Vienna. Saman Kujuri has more.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign ministry spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli settlers attack a Palestinian village in the occupied West Bank, setting brush fires and hurling stones at villagers. Israeli rights group B'Tselem said clashes broke out when Israeli settlers attacked Palestinian homes overnight in the village of Jalud. The NGO said Israeli soldiers arrested 11 Palestinian villagers and wounded 4 others by firing rubber bullets. Separately, clashes broke out in the village of Beita in the northern West Bank. Israeli forces attacked Palestinians who held a protest during an Israeli military raid. The Palestinian Health Ministry said 5 villagers were wounded with live ammunition during the protest. Mona Condil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah to give us the latest on what has happened. Robert Fantina is an author and journalist who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario, in order to give us an analysis on this. Mona, what has happened exactly, and what do we know about the arrests that have taken place?
Well, let's speak about the village of Jalud. Israeli settlers raided the village of Jalud, south Nablus, and attempted to kidnap a Palestinian child, according to Palestinians living there. The villagers tried to rescue the child. The settlers attacked the people, and they clashed with the Palestinians living in Jalut. A number of Palestinians were wounded, especially that Israeli forces rushed to make sure about the safety and to rescue the settlers there. Several hours before this incident, also settlers and Israeli forces raided a number of villages north the occupied West Bank, mainly around of Nablus, and 5 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli army fire. The Israelis were conducting a search after a shooting that took place at the Za'atar checkpoint, central the occupied West Bank, where the Israelis said the 3 settlers were wounded when a Palestinian vehicle, or at least a vehicle with a Palestinian license plate, stopped at the Za'atar checkpoint and opened fire at the settlers there, wounding the 3. And up till the moment, the Israeli forces are still looking for this vehicle and the people who were inside it.
Thank you very much for that. Okay, let's turn to you, Robert Fantina. When we take a look at the Israeli settlers, they have a certain culture which is obviously very anti-Palestinian, and they are very rough with the Palestinians. And at the core of it is one of the issues that has not been resolved over the decades, and that is the rightful right that Palestinians have on their land, of which the settlers claim to be their own. Tell us a little bit about that, if you can, and why it is that the settlers have such a severe violence-oriented attitude towards the Palestinians.
The settlers have been taught that this land has been given to them by God, which is certainly a nonsensical teaching and a nonsensical belief. They believe that they're superior and that the Palestinians are less than human. They attack them, they take their land, as you mentioned, they destroy Palestinian homes with complete impunity. They're not only, does the IDF not stop them, the IDF supports them in doing this, in committing these crimes against humanity and these violations of international law. Israeli settlers who are there illegally under international law simply believe that they can take what they want. Their government has told them repeatedly, the government of Netanyahu and previous governments, that the Palestinians who've lived there for thousands of years are the interlopers. They are the ones who do not belong there. They are the ones who need to be driven off. This is this myth is believed by some of them who would prefer to have this housing given to them, this citizenship given to them. And at the expense of the Palestinians. The fact that this brutality, this injustice continues to this day and is ignored by most of the international community is beyond shocking.
Mona, have we seen other or similar type incidents happen in any of the settlements in terms of the settlers or clashes with Palestinians, aside from the one that's happened today?
Well, it's the Israeli settlers have been almost every night rushed to the streets, mainly the streets that are used by the Palestinians near the illegal settlements, mainly in the north of the occupied West Bank and near the Palestinian city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. And they start throwing the stones and the rocks at the Palestinian vehicles, especially that the Palestinian vehicles are known for their green license plates. However, the Israeli ones are yellow license plate. So they know that this vehicle would be for a Palestinian. They attack the people. They have been attacking the people mainly in the several last weeks. And this have intensified with the start of the holy month of Ramadan, even in Jerusalem, Al-Quds.
Thank you very much for that. Mona Kandila, correspondent from Occupied Ramallah. Robert Fantina, thank you. Author and journalist there from Kitchener, Ontario. And that does it for our news review. The European Union says it summons Russia's ambassador to Brussels to convey its, quote, strong condemnation and rejection of Moscow's retaliatory sanctions on European officials. The EU spokesman, Peter Stano, said the counter-sanctions are politically motivated and lack any legal justification. On Friday, Russia announced an entry ban on 8 European officials, including the head of the European Parliament. Moscow described the move as a response to sanctions imposed by the EU on Russian citizens. Moscow and Brussels are at loggerheads over a host of issues. Tensions have recently hiked over the alleged poisoning and jailing of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Brussels and Washington have imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia over Navalny's case. A senior UK Tory official has called for the resignation of Prime Minister Boris Johnson in case he has broken the ministerial code. The leader of the Scottish Conservatives, Douglas Ross, says Johnson should quit if he fails to be honest about the funding of his Downing Street flat upgrade. Boris Johnson is under fire for using undeclared donations to fund his lavish lifestyle. Meanwhile, the Electoral Commission launched a probe into the affair. However, the government has rejected the allegations. It says the Premier has paid the cost himself. The allegations seem to have taken its toll on the ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows the party is losing its popularity ahead of the upcoming elections. The renovations at the British Prime Minister's residence have reportedly cost as much as £200,000. That is while the Premier receives only a £30,000 public grant for that purpose. Other reports also suggest that Tory donors were approached to pay for the expenses of Johnson's one-year-old child. The government has dismissed the allegations as mere tittle-tattle, arguing that attention must be focused on addressing the challenges that Britons are facing, but shouldn't the government's top agenda be controlling how taxpayers' money is spent? The U.S. announced the completion of a review of its policy toward North Korea after decades of failures and a reliance on pressure and sanctions. This followed comments by President Joe Biden calling North Korea a threat. Pyongyang was quick to respond, warning Washington that it would face a very grave situation if it did not withdraw its hostile policy. Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
U.S. President Joe Biden called North Korea a threat in his first address to Congress, as his administration announced it had completed a long-awaited review of American policy toward Pyongyang. Biden's remarks were soon followed up by his Director of National Intelligence.
For its part, North Korea may take aggressive and potentially destabilizing actions to reshape its security environment and will seek to drive wedges between the United States and its allies. These efforts could include the resumption of nuclear weapons and intercontinental ballistic missile testing in the future.
North Korea reacted harshly to the comments, with a leading official saying the U.S. would face a very grave situation if it did not end its hostile policy. In South Korea, Washington's rhetoric was met with disappointment.
The Biden administration has said it will pursue resolute deterrence while the North Korean nuclear issue is a threat to the world peace. So for Pyongyang, Washington's hostile policy seems only a pretext to strengthen itself.
North Korea has been subject to U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which Pyongyang would like to be suspended. There are also other moves the U.S. could make to get talks going.
Since there is a large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises in August that North Korea sees as a hostile, an announcement suspending these drills would help create an atmosphere of dialogue.
South Korean President Moon Jae-in is set to meet with President Biden at the Oval Office later this month, where he's likely to press for engagement between the U.S. and North Korea. U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan said Sunday that Washington's policies not aimed at hostility, but solutions. The question is whether those solutions involve U.S. incentives that will bring Pyongyang to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
India's total coronavirus caseload has neared the grim milestone of 20 million as the country is struggling with curbing a deadly surge of the virus. India's health ministry has registered over 368,000 new infections in the past 24 hours. And the country's total COVID-19 death toll stands at nearly 219,000. Monday marks the fifth straight day that India registered more than 3,000 daily deaths. Hospitals in India are currently overwhelmed, and a shortage of medical oxygen is the most serious challenge. India's COVID-19 crisis is blamed on a new virus variant, as well as mass political gatherings and religious events. Munawar Zaman says health experts suggest a nationwide lockdown to contain the COVID-19 surge, but the government is reluctant.
Scientists and medical experts are suggesting the country to impose a nationwide lockdown immediately to contain the virus. But it seems from the government side that there is no sign of the lockdown yet, because considering the population of the country and poor population who live on just hand to mouth. So I believe the country cannot impose a lockdown again, because it's a very challenging task for the country, because the economy, last time if you remember, the economy has had more than 100 million people below poverty line. So the country will think very deeply before imposing any national lockdown, but that cannot be off the table as well, because if the death toll continues to mount with the speed it is right now, then I think it is evident that the country might go ahead with the lockdown. Back to you.
Paris prosecutors have asked judges to drop a case accusing senior members of the French armed forces of complicity in the 1994 Rwandan genocide. In a statement, the prosecutor's department said that there were no grounds to pursue legal claims that France bore responsibility in the mass killings. However, the final decision over whether to press ahead with the case rests with the French investigating magistrates. The call to drop the 15-year-old case comes after a major report in March on allegations about France's role in the genocide. The 600-page report commissioned by the Rwandan government says that Paris bears significant responsibility for the mass killings. Some 800,000 people, mostly from the Tutsi ethnic minority, were slaughtered by the rival Hutu community between April and July 1994. Tehran officials and academics have gathered to celebrate the National Persian Gulf Day. The occasion is celebrated every year in response to efforts by some countries to change the name of the waterway. Their efforts, however, have so far remained futile. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Iranian officials here say the Persian Gulf will not be called with any forged names. They gathered in Tehran to celebrate the National Persian Gulf Day. The occasion marks the anniversary of the expulsion of Portuguese military forces from the Strait of Hormuz back in 1622 by Iranian forces. The move to designate such a day came in 2004 in response to a wave of efforts by some of Iran's Arab neighbors to change the name of the waterway to the Arabian Gulf. But to no avail. The first attempts to forge a new name for the Persian Gulf were made after the onset of Arabic nationalism in the 1960s, with alternative terms such as the Arabian Gulf or the Gulf being proposed. In 2006, the UN put the final word on it by officially recognizing the Persian Gulf as the historical and international name of the body of water.
There are 6,000 historical maps that show that the term Persian Gulf has been used in different languages since 400 BC. But officials say it's more than just calling a spade, since there are political and economic drives behind attempts to drop the word Persian from the historical name.
Iran has an 1,800-kilometer-long border with the Persian Gulf to its south. The country is in charge of providing the security of the strategic waterway, especially the Strait of Hormuz, which hosts one-fifth of the world's oil shipment. Officials here say, along with efforts to change the name of the strategic body of water, there are also attempts by extraterritorial forces to undermine the security of the Persian Gulf. The Persian Gulf stretches for some 250,000 square kilometers. Half of this vast expanse belongs to Iran, and the rest is shared by seven littoral countries. To Iranians, the strategic waterway is more than just a source of income, but a symbol of national identity and a legacy from the country's ancient civilization. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The FBI has the authority to access privately owned computers without their own knowledge or consent and to delete software, says Scott Shackelford, a writer, in an article published under the heading FBI Quietly Breaking into U.S. Corporate Computers. Stay tuned, please, for the details. Thank you. The FBI has the authority right now to access privately owned computers without their own knowledge or consent and to delete software. It's part of a government effort to contain the continuing attacks on corporate networks running Microsoft Exchange software, and it's an unprecedented intrusion that's raising legal questions about just how far the government can go. On April 9th, the United States District Court for the Southern District of Texas approved a search warrant allowing the U.S. Department of Justice to carry out the operation. The software the FBI is deleting is malicious code installed by hackers to take control of a victim's computer. Hackers have used the code to access vast amounts of private email messages and to launch ransomware attacks. The authority the Justice Department relied on and the way the FBI carried out the operation set important precedents. They also raise questions about the power of courts to regulate cybersecurity without the consent of the owners of the targeted computers. Public-private cooperation is critical for managing the wide range of cyber threats facing the U.S., but it poses challenges, including determining how far the government can go in the name of national security. It's also important for Congress and the courts to oversee this balancing act. Since at least January 2021, hacking groups have been using zero-day exploits, meaning previously unknown vulnerabilities in Microsoft Exchange to access email accounts. The hackers use this access to insert web shell software that allows them to remotely control the compromised systems and networks. Tens of thousands of email users and organizations have been affected. One result has been a series of ransomware attacks which encrypt victims' files and hold the keys to decrypt them for ransom. On March 2, 2021, Microsoft announced that a hacking group codenamed Hafnium had been using multiple zero-day exploits to install web shells with unique file names and paths. This makes it challenging for administrators to remove the malicious code, even with the tools and patches Microsoft and cybersecurity firms have released to assist the victims. The FBI is accessing hundreds of these mail servers in corporate networks. The search warrant allows the FBI to access the web shells, enter the previously discovered password for a web shell, make a copy for evidence, and then delete the web shell. The FBI, though, was not authorized to remove any other malware that hackers might have installed during the breach or otherwise access the contents of the servers. What makes this case unique is both the scope of the FBI's actions to remove the web shells and the unprecedented intrusion into privately owned computers without the owner's consent. The FBI overtook the operation without consent because of the large number of unprotected systems throughout U.S. networks and the urgency of the threat. The action demonstrates the Justice Department's commitment to using all of our legal tools, Assistant Attorney General John Demers said in a statement. The total number of compromised firms remains murky given that the figure is redacted in the court documents, but it could be as many as 68,000 exchange servers, which would potentially affect millions of email users. New malware attacks on Microsoft Exchange servers continue to surface, and the FBI is continuing to undertake court-authorized action to remove the malicious code. The shift toward a more active U.S. cybersecurity strategy began under the Obama administration with the establishment of U.S. Cyber Command in 2010. The emphasis at the time remained on deterrence by denial, meaning making computers harder to hack. This includes using a layered defense, also known as defense in depth, to make it more difficult, expensive, and time-consuming to break into networks. The alternative is to go after hackers' strategy dubbed Defend Forward. This new FBI action similarly pushes the envelope of active defense, in this case to clean up the aftermath of domestic breaches, though without the awareness or consent of the affected organizations. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act generally makes it illegal to access a computer without authorization. This law, though, does not apply to the government. The FBI has the power to remove malicious code from private computers without permission thanks to a change in 2016 to Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure. This revision was designed in part to enable the U.S. government to more easily battle botnets and aid other cybercrime investigations in situations where the perpetrators' locations remain unknown. It permits the FBI to access computers outside the jurisdiction of a search warrant. This action highlights the precedent and power of courts becoming de facto cybersecurity regulators that can empower the Department of Justice to clean up large-scale deployments of malicious code of the kind seen in the Exchange hack. In 2017, for example, the FBI made use of the expanded Rule 41 to take down a global botnet that harvested victims' information and used their computers to send spam emails. Important legal issues remain unresolved with the FBI current operation. One is the question of liability. What if, for example, the privately owned computers were damaged in the FBI's process of removing the malicious code? Another issue is how to balance private property rights against national security needs in cases like this. What is clear, though, is that under this authority, the FBI could hack into computers at will and without the need for a specific search warrant. Much of U.S. critical infrastructure, which includes computer networks, is in private hands. Yet companies have not always made the necessary investments to protect their customers. This raises the question of whether there has been a market failure in cybersecurity where economic incentives haven't been sufficient to result in adequate cyber defenses. With the FBI's actions, the Biden administration may be implicitly acknowledging such a market failure. The subcontinent.
Hi everyone, this is Don, and I welcome you back to another episode of The Subcontinent. Our program aims to address important issues in the subcontinent which affect the governments, people, organizations, and the region of South Asia as a whole. We will try to explain the issues, break down controversies surrounding them, and try to have some external perspectives from experts and people.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we are going to talk about India's nascent alliance called Quad with Japan and Australia, as well as the United States, and its impact on geopolitics of the Indo-Pacific region. And we shall also take a look at the recent rise of Maoist attacks in India, and the prospects of peace for the decades-old insurgency.
Some call it the Asian NATO, but many believe this is a misnomer. The Quad is a combination of a couple of trilateral ties with India or US at the center that is now shaped into a four-way partnership. The quadrilateral security dialogues bringing together United States, Japan, Australia, and India, but such an alliance may provoke a spiraling set of reactions from other Asian players such as China and Russia.
Consequently, this week, the OECD...
Leaders of the four-member Quad grouping, or the Quadrilateral Security Dialogue, held their first summit mid-March 2021, but the strategic partnership, presumably against China, was in the making since the beginning of the century. The Quad was first established by then-President George W. Bush following the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami and, after a long hiatus, was reconvened by Donald Trump in 2017. Its advertised aim was fostering a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific region, but the implicit goal was to address concerns about Beijing's growing economic influence, military prowess, and technological heft. Although this year's virtual meeting focused on non-military initiatives and China was never mentioned in any statements or proceedings, the Quad has the potential to further divide the already complex geopolitical arrangement of Asia. Its extension, or the Quad Plus, including France, Canada, and perhaps the United Kingdom or New Zealand, may prompt a counter-axis with Russia or Pakistan in tandem with China.
India and three other Quad countries have recently kicked off a major naval exercise along with France in the Bay of Bengal. Such drills may be seen as a show of military might by these countries who don't mention it but are apparently concerned about China's growing military. But Quad wants to be more than that. The members of the Quad and some of their friends believe the baby alliance has also the bandwidth to challenge non-security frontiers of Beijing's global influence.
The March 12th summit wrapped up with no direct reference to China, but the joint statement by Quad's four leaders was telling of a different story. The Quad leaders established working groups about COVID-19 vaccine development as well as cooperation in emerging technologies plus climate change. On the first glance, they seem irrelevant to China, but they are aimed at addressing the broader aspects of Beijing's central position in the global system. China is a pivotal player in international supply chains. This had never been so noticeable for the Quad members before the pandemic necessitated universal vaccine production and distribution. The Quad seeks to restructure supply chains to wean them away from Beijing. Another Quad initiative is to undercut China's influence in telecom and biotech. And climate activism is only there for the global appeal. All of these members have other bilateral or multilateral alliances or PACs specifically for the promulgated goals of Quad. They did not deliver, so what makes them expect a different result from a new name or clothing?
Now, to learn more about Quad and its purpose and aims, we have with us Mr. Victor Gao. He's the chair and professor of Suzhou University and the vice president of CCG. Mr. Gao, welcome to the program. So, what are the consequences of the formation of Quad, or as some call it, Asian NATO? Can we even call it an Asian NATO?
First of all, I think the fundamental premise for the formation of Quad, that is an informal alliance involving the United States, Japan, India, and Australia, is very much misplaced. Why? Because I think in the world of today, people want to have peace and development rather than having a resurgence of another Cold War or a conflict leading to a total war. And from the Chinese perspective, any attempt by one country or several countries to form a so-called alliance to contain China will be a failure because it's impossible to contain a big and great country like China with 1.4 billion people bent upon peace and development. And China is now contributing anywhere roughly around one-third of any additional GDP growth for any given year in recent years. Therefore, to contain China and try to stop China's peaceful economic development is suicidal for the United States and other countries. Therefore, I think Quad, if it is designed to contain China, will be a miserable failure. And you can call Quad by any other name, for example, Asian NATO, for example, it will not be a success. It will not deliver the results that its member countries want to see it deliver.
All right, so you think it's a failure and it would be suicidal. Now, can India use Quad for its own gains?
I think you need to ask Indian government or some experts in India for this question. From our perspective, I think India is a developing country, it's a non-aligned country. It will serve India's interest better if it continues its non-aligned position, because that's really the core and the strength of Indian diplomacy for the past several decades. Secondly, India can really do a big favor for its own people and its own government if it maintains a focus on peace and stability and maintain good neighborly relations with its neighbors, including with China. China does not want to have a conflict or a war or confrontation with India. Both China and India are great countries with ancient histories, and we share a very long land boundary with each other. And both China and India need better investments and need to do more to improve the living standards of the Chinese people on the one hand and the Indian people on the other hand. We do not want to have a war. A war is not good for China. The war is not good for India. So let's talk peace rather than talk about war.
Now, how would China see or react to such a potential alliance?
Now, first of all, I don't think there is such an alliance to start with. What they are talking about is a very loose structure with no written document endorsed by their parliaments, elevating their relationship into an alliance. No, it's not an alliance, a very loose structure to start with. Secondly, I don't think these countries or these people really want to contain China. Why? Because it's a mission impossible. How can you contain a very big, important country, the biggest contributor to the global economic growth, the largest population in the world, and one of the strongest military in the world? So I think these countries will realize, including their people and their government, they will realize the futility of such attempt to contain China and the destructiveness of the attempt to set up a so-called alliance involving these four countries. These four countries aligned together will not be able to defeat China or hold China to the ground. They are talking about complete indulgence in fantasies rather than talking about realities on the ground. The Chinese government and the Chinese people do not want to have a war or conflict with any of these four countries. We want to have peace with them. We want to talk about business and cooperation and economic and financial cooperation included, for example. So we have better things to talk about rather than war or conflict or confrontation.
All right, that's a very interesting point. Now, isn't the Quad just another way of America to have military presence in the region?
Well, the United States is very much the mastermind of Quad, whatever it means and whatever it will evolve into. And I think the United States is really very much losing its own sanity over the rapid economic development over the past decades and the economic disparity between the United States on the one hand and China on the other hand is very fast narrowing. As of the end of last year, China is already about 70%, if not a little bit more, than the United States, compared with the United States in terms of the overall size of the GDP, if we use official exchange rate as the benchmark. And there are lots of economists who are talking about that by another 10 years, if not even less, the Chinese economy, if we use the official exchange rate as the benchmark, will surpass that of the United States. And I think in China, we are very much confident that given the unity of China, given the strong leadership of China, the execution ability, delivery capacities of the Chinese government, and the overall support of the Chinese people for the peace and development strategies adopted by the Chinese government, China will surpass the economic size of the United States in about 10 years, if not even less. But does that mean that China wants to replace the United States as the top dog in the world? No, I don't think the Chinese government or the Chinese people want to be the top dog of the world. We want to see a world in a multilateral format, and every country, big or small, will be treated as an equal sovereign. And that's very, very important. And I think we all need to rally behind the United Nations, and we should not do anything to bully other countries, to violate the legitimate interests of the other countries, and to put yourself on top of the United Nations.
All right. Thank you so much, Mr. Gao, for being with us on our program. It was very nice having you. Before moving ahead, let's just take a quick look at what's been going on cyberspace and social media.
Ronald Van Keekum has talked about the NATO-style alliance against China. Tom Fowdy has made fun of US double standard policies. He highlighted that Washington is only a friend to India in its rivalry against China and nowhere else. Navendra Tripathi called Quad the first step in the formation of a bigger front against China. Rab Rakha believes China should counter a threat such as Quad, and he believes it starts with doing something about India. Memory has tweeted a quote by a Chinese professor downgrading the Quad.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
In India, more than 20 policemen were killed in a recent ambush by Maoist militants in the mineral-rich state of Chhattisgarh. This came about a month after another similar attack by Maoist Naxal militants who have been waging attacks since 1967. The recent rise of Maoist attacks in India has revived concerns about this decades-old insurgency that has appeared largely contained. What does this resurgence mean for India?
Maoist militants, often referred to as Naxalite or Naxals, trace their roots to communist politics. They use violence against the state in the name of championing the cause of India's poor and marginalized. Naxalite groups have been active in the country since the 1960s, but the modern insurgency did not begin until the early 2000s. Since 1967, the group has asserted control over vast swaths of land in central and eastern India, establishing a so-called Red Corridor. the reach of the outfit was once so widespread and their attacks so frequent that in 2006, India's Prime Minister declared them the country's single biggest internal security challenge. The Indian government has hunted many of the insurgent leaders, killing a large number or forcing them to surrender. This, along with years of infighting, has declined the insurgent attacks in frequency and potency. Nevertheless, the group continues to launch hit-and-run attacks, ambushing security forces in friendly terrain and inflicting casualties in deadly battles.
According to data by the South Asia Terrorism Portal, over 100 people have been killed this year, and it's only April now. More than 2,100 civilians in India have been killed in the Maoist insurgency since 2010. The government's inability to contain such a homegrown insurgency has a heavy and bloody cost for the civilians and security personnel alike in areas under their reach. And the prospects for peace look dim because these areas are among the poorest in the country. Bad living conditions feed such an insurgency.
Although the insurgency has largely weakened since the 2010s, the well-planned ambush of this march and incidents of this kind are far from a novelty in the Maoist hotbeds. The change of Maoist leadership in late 2018 was seen as the return to increasingly aggressive tactics, such as assassinations of prominent figures and multi-pronged hits. But the ongoing pandemic seems to have impacted the insurgents' supply lines, thus hindering further attacks. The Indian government needs a coherent, long-term remedial approach. The current situation is paradoxical. Authorities turn to military force saturation and rely on disproportionate kinetic responses in Maoist-prone tribal areas. This keeps these regions underdeveloped and inhabitants unhappy, which in turn boost Maoist recruitments.
Now, to have more insight about the Naxalites and the Maoist insurgency in India, we are joined by Colonel Danveer Singh, who is an associate editor of the Indian Defence Review. Mr. Singh, welcome to the program. So, what do Maoists in India really want? Are they a serious threat?
Okay, this is a very interesting question because generally people think that it is a movement of some sort of separatism. So let me make it very, very clear that Maoist movement is not a separatist movement. It is a movement for regime change. These people follow the ideology of Mao from China, and they are not happy with the democratic system prevailing in India. They say that it is a capitalist system that exists in India, inherited from the Britishers. It oppresses the weak and the poor, and the oppression is by the capitalist people, and the state is representative of these oppressors. So Maoists want to free the country from the oppressors per se, and they want to establish communist rule exactly on the lines of the Chinese Communist Party. So this is what their whole agenda and idea about this insurgency or this violence is.
The cost of government's inability to control the Maoists are the lives of the people. How can India handle the Maoist insurgency?
See, this Maoist insurgency is to be handled on various fronts. I personally feel, very firstly, it is to be handled at social level, wherein the people, affected people, or the people who reside in jungles and remote areas, they have to be provided by some kind of social security. When we talk of social security, in it, it involves medical, it involves food, it involves various other amenities that other people do enjoy. Then we have to carry out administrative reforms, because administrative reforms are key to building a trustworthy connect between the poor, downtrodden, and those who are ruling or the system. So to integrate system with the people, you have to carry out administrative reforms. And administrative reforms are absolutely necessary because they are very archaic. We have inherited these systems from the British. They are not Indian system. They are not sensitive to the local way of thinking and living. So that is another point. Then we graduate on to other aspects of military. That is, we have to counter the propaganda war of the Maoists with great intensity. And lastly, we have to carry out friendly operations, military operations that do not harm the locals, but they target the Maoists. So we have to function on various levels, like I mentioned, to repeat them again. We have social, administrative, information, and military. So these are the four prongs that we have to invoke to counter the Maoist strategy. Otherwise, Maoists will continue to have their grip on the very low and far-flung strata living in the jungles of central India.
Now, during the time of Premier Manmohan Singh, it was believed that Naxalites or Naxalism was the greatest threat to Indian internal security. Do you think it is still the case?
As I mentioned, what Manmohan Singh had said in 2010 was absolute a reality, because that was a time when all the disturbed areas combined, that is to do with the northeastern region, Kashmir, and the Maoist Red Corridor, it almost made up to 70% of India's landmass. That was very huge. That was extremely huge. So when he said that, that was a very right thing that he said that. Now things have changed. While the India still be 70% in a sense that the ideology or the Maoist ideology still resonates in the corners, but when it comes to Maoist insurgency, it is not that 70%. In that 70%, I included Northeast as well. So today, when we are talking, Northeast is virtually or literally free of insurgency, literally free. And Maoist insurgency out of 6-7 states, it has reduced and is confined to a very limited area of a small state called Chhattisgarh. That is all. Kashmir insurgency has also come down drastically, which is also on the verge of complete collapse, because it is also breathing its last. So when we look at the complete scenario and that 70% that I quoted, I don't think so. It is more than 10 to 15% as you and me are talking.
All right, Mr. Singh, thank you so much for being with us on our show. It was really nice having you here. Now, before ending, let's just take a quick look at the social media and cyberspace and what they think about the Naxalites and what's going on in India. Thank you.
Siddharth Kaushal believes that the Indian government should do whatever it can to contain the Maoist insurgency. ARI Videos has shared videos to commemorate all those killed in Maoist attacks. This account with the handle Global Cyber Police says, with proper resources, he can eradicate the Maoist insurgency.
And this concludes our episode on the Quad Summit and the Maoist insurgency in India. We shall meet next week.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird. Eutelsat-3B, and Iransat or BADR-5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.